So it would have been $3. It would have been.
Visit paltalk.com. Go to the social issues, select other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, hmm. My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Strange days have found us.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and along with my co-host, Victor the Voice Furman, with Second Sight NYC. Victor, who do we have as a guest this week?
Chris, our guest this week is Ed Ozoski, author of the book, The Paranormal World and the Study of Paranormal Phenomena.
Victor, in my paranormal world, the spirits are always present. I talk to them and I drink them.
There's whiskey in the gyro.
Whoa, did you hear?
Listen to the Church of Mavis radio show, hosted by Jeffrey Pritchett, 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights.
Follow your weird and journey into the high strange. Be sure to stop by
www.churchofmavisradio.com
for upcoming shows, paranormal news, and show archives. That's
www.churchofmavisradio.com.
I am pleased to announce Truth Connections Radio is coming to UPRN 107.7 FM out of New Orleans at the Paranormal Radio Network. This is Catherine Buckaloo. Check out our archives at truthconnections.wordpress.com. Meanwhile, see you in October.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak.
Truth Connections.
Okay. Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and despite a few technical difficulties tonight, we do have our usual announcements to make before we get started. Now, for all of you Facebookers out there, we do have a Facebook group specifically used for this radio program, and it provides an easy way to make comments or even ask questions about the program in general. I do not monitor the page during the program, so please don't try to answer a question during a show there. But go ahead and join the group. We'd be happy to have you do so. I also have an author page on Facebook, and I would like to invite everyone to visit and find out what's going on with the things that I write. So you can check it out and help one more starving author, right? Now, for tonight's program, like all programs, I would love to have the audience's input with questions and comments. You can email them to me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. You can also email me with questions from previous guests, and I will try and get those answered for you as well. And before we go any further, here's a word from one of our sponsors for tonight's program, Massacre Publishing, which you can find at Massacre Publishing, all one word, is having a flash fiction contest. Now, it's a lot of fun, and whether or not you've ever tried your hand at fiction, here's your chance. So, take a look at the photograph on the website and let your horror thoughts run wild in just 250 words. Then, send it in through the website, super easy, with the words Winter Contest in the subject line. There's some great prizes, and it's a lot of fun, so give it a shot. Now remember, go check out massacrepublishing.com and read more about it there. Just click on Fearsome Flashers in the left-hand navigation bar. Now tonight we're continuing our series, Talking Threads, but I also wanted to let everybody know that on October 1st, the Dawn of Shades will be moving to a new time slot. Instead of the 7 to 9 central time slot that we currently occupy, we will be going to 8 to 10 p.m. Central Time. So remember, on October 1st, we'll be coming on the air an hour later than we have been. Now, the series will run through October 8th and features indigenous writers who are all contributors to an anthology called Unraveling the Spreading Cloth of Time. Now, we have two of them joining us tonight, so please welcome Susan Deercloud and Carol Vlett. Bachofner. Hopefully I got that right. Carol, would you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Carol, and I'm happy to be here tonight. I live and write in Rockland, Maine. I'm a native Mainer, grew up in Maine, lived away for a number of years, lived abroad, lived all over the place, and I'm back. So I'm happy to be here on the coast of Maine, and happy to be a writer.
Okay. Well, Carol, I'm happy that we have you on the program tonight, too. And Susan, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself now?
Okay. I'm going to pretend I'm somebody else. I grew up in the Catskill Mountains, and we have an expression here that we're not supposed to brag on ourselves, so I'm going to read the back of my latest book, Fox Mountain, and again, just pretend I'm another person while I do this bragging on myself. So it goes, Susan Deercloud is a mixed lineage mountain Indian from the Catskills, an alumna of Binghamton University, BA and MA, and Goddard College, MFA. She is the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship, two New York State Foundation for the Arts Poetry Fellowship, an Elizabeth George Foundation grant, and a Chenango County Council for the Arts Individual Artist Grant. Her work has been published in numerous literary journals and anthologies. Her most recent books are Braiding Starlight, The Last Ceremony, and Car Stealer. She likes to eat blueberries in winter and sing to feral cats.
Well, that's sweet. And, you know, when you bring up that bragging on yourself thing, so often, you know, whether we're going to apply for a new job and be interviewed for that, or having to write a bio for ourselves for a website or a book or whatever, that bragging on ourself thing is very difficult, isn't it, Susan?
I wanted to mention it because I don't think it's very easy for people of indigenous background and also of country mountain background to talk about themselves. And those of us who have become writers and who live in this age of self-advertising, and we find a lot of times we have to do it, it takes a long time to get accustomed to that at all.
I agree with you, Susan. It's really difficult. I like to call it my inverted side or my shy side. And most people who know me think I'm outgoing, but I'm not outgoing inside. I'm ingoing inside. And so it's really difficult. And every time I have to write a bio, I think, oh, do these people want to know that? Do they care? Should they care? And yet we have to do it. It's the business side, I guess you could call it, of being a writer or a storyteller, and it's really uncomfortable.
It is. It's something, you know, that beating your own drum thing is what it was always referred to when I was growing up, and girls especially are discouraged from doing so.
And then there was that whole be seen and not heard thing, too, and I thought, well, you know, if you're... It seems so odd because if you're not heard, how are you seen? And if you're seen, then aren't you being heard? And it just was so confusing growing up and as I said, uncomfortable. It's still uncomfortable for me, and I'm certainly not a child anymore, but still uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's some of the fun part of it, though, because so many of us women were told to keep our voices more to ourselves when we were growing up, and I've sometimes said that I did not start speaking until I was a half a century old, and so I look at it and see if I can have some fun with doing all the speaking I'm doing now. I've come across a lot of women writers who have told me that they were really quite shy when they were girls, and also a lot of them tell me they were tomboys.
Well, I definitely qualify in both the shy and the tomboy. You know,
I can tell.
Yeah.
No, I'm laughing. You know why I'm laughing? Because, see, I could see that you're shy in what you were saying before about when we were not on the air yet about needing to get into nature and to be solitary. but I sometimes when I tell people now that I'm really very shy, they just burst out laughing.
Well, people, you know, really, you know, because when I tell people, you know, I'm very shy and I do internet radio, they laugh. And I've done a lot of public speaking, too. But it's different.
Yes.
The person that you hear on the air isn't, or see at a podium, is not talking about herself. As long as I don't have to talk about me, I can be quite a chatterbox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's true.
Yeah.
I'm much more comfortable talking about my work, for example, or talking about other people's works. I love doing that. I love teaching. I did that for quite a while, and I still do it. I'm no longer teaching in a classroom, but I teach workshops, and I'm really comfortable doing all of that. All of that is just fine, but it's when I have to promote myself.
See,
then,
you know, somebody else said it to this series.
That's the rock I trip over.
What we need to do is get a circle together, and each of us promotes somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, because it would be so much easier for me to write a bio about you or Susan and somebody else write mine and vice versa, you know, through the entire circle. because we do, you know, I really can see where this inability to promote yourself because of cultural indoctrination or habits or however you want to put it is a problem for people.
And I think that's why it's so good to have someone write a blurb for the back of your book, because they are looking at the work and they know you, and they can be passionate about it, where if you're so passionate about yourself, you know, it comes off as braggadocio or somebody's being, you know, stuck up or whatever. And so I love it when somebody else writes about me, because then it's, oh, phew, I'm off the hook. I don't have to, you know, cross over that line and wonder whether I went too far, didn't go far enough, didn't say the right things, and not knowing what other people want to know is another part of that. So I like it when I can just send the work out and someone else will write about it and write about me, and I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I can definitely see that being very, very helpful to people. Now, you both write poetry, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
You know, we were talking.
I'm going to only speak for me here.
But you know, the thing is that we were talking there again before we went on the air tonight about, you know, internet radio not being a high paying career choice, and so is being poetry. You know, so how does someone who is called to poetry, you know, do you do it, you know, as a moonlighting thing, or is there a way to turn it into a career?
Well, I consider myself a working poet, and yet, you know, I have books, and the books sell, and, you know, people buy them. Mm-hmm. And but primarily, it's like limping along a little bit, because you have to rely on having, I guess, what somebody would call a day job. I don't know that I'd call it that, but you know, you have to have some source of, you know, putting food on the table. So many poets teach. That certainly is an option. Sometimes the person, you know, has a spouse who has a good paying job, and so, you know, but you're basically cobbling together the ways and means of your life other than your poetry, because for some reason people who write fiction, for example, people who write novels, you think of J.K. Rowling, she's the most commercially successful author ever. She's a billionaire. But that didn't happen, that's not going to happen to a poet. You know, somehow poetry seems to be in another level of ether where people expect poetry to just be available to them pretty much for free. I've had people come to my readings and say to me, well, can you email me that poem? I really like that poem. And, you know, there's the book sitting there that they could purchase. And yet they think it would just be no big deal to have the poet send them a free poem. So it's a touchy area. It's iffy.
You know, sometimes I wonder with the poetry, you know, in a lot of ways, poetry's been intellectualized, I guess. It's not something that, you know, average Joe really reads all that often, even. You know, when I go into a bookstore, you never see books on poetry displayed on the end caps. I'm assuming bookstores still exist. I mean, I know that a lot of them are gone.
Yeah, the independent bookstores do prominently feature poetry. So I would say that it's better, that's better, but again, it's the idea that poetry exists in a different part of the universe that isn't commercialized, and that it's almost something too sacred to be for sale. And so we have that kind of funny attitude toward poetry, I think, that doesn't exist in other genres. But I've been lately kind of toying with the idea of doing a reading and putting out a tip jar. You know, if you go to a coffee house and there's a group playing instruments, they often say no cover charge, but tips are appreciated, and they pass the hat around, and the musicians get paid. And I'm thinking,
well, maybe poetry is going to have to exist that way, where the poet has a tip jar, and the person who has already bought your book or who doesn't want to buy your book because it's too expensive in their mind would throw a couple bucks in a jar. So I don't know. It's just an idea. But I think it's not a bad idea.
Well, I was wondering, too, many people appreciate the poetry in a audio form, but not everyone can go to a reading. You know, perhaps audio files, very like a song, but in the spoken word, would be the answer, where people simply buy a single copy of a single poem.
Yeah, and that's another thing you might just do at a reading is have single copies for sale. You know, have printed out copies. But, you know, that seems so, I don't know, it just seems odd to me. I don't know the answer to this, Gia. I really don't.
Well, I could
but
see
I
where...
But I certainly fuss about it in my head all the time.
The idea of people going to iTunes and buying your poem like people go and buy a song.
Yeah, I think that would be great. I think that would be great. We should start that, Susan. We should start a company.
Well, I've just been listening to the two of you, and you've touched on so many aspects of poetry, including, Carol, you used the word sacred. And I think a lot of us who write have that feeling about poetry, which kind of ends up hurting us in terms of our basic survival, but I know that sacred's a highly charged word for a lot of people, but poetry is sacred to a lot of us. And for me, I've sometimes called poetry my one constant lover, and I really wake up every morning with that feeling of being in love because I love this thing called poetry. It pervades my life. But this attitude that others have, it's interesting because I see an overlapping. They think that poets, for some reason, can survive on eating air and drinking leaves, and they tend to think the same thing about Native people. That we are somehow above needing money in this society we live in, but we do need it, and it's a serious matter for us. And as with you, Carol, I've done that cobbling thing, and I've taught, and I've given poetry readings for pay. Universities especially are good for that. But of there are these huge funding cuts now that's made it harder for all of us. And then I've gotten some fellowships and grants, but those are not easy to get. It's highly competitive to get an NEA fellowship or a New York State Foundation for the Arts fellowship. The competition is extreme. When I've gotten these fellowships, well over 1,000 people have applied for them.
Oh, yes, easily.
Really
easily.
Rough. Oh, yes, yeah.
My poetry group was talking today about how kind of incestuous, in a way, the society that we call poetry is in some ways, where the same people keep getting the same awards over and over again and keep getting, and for example, you know, Ruth Lilly, when she died, she left a bundle of money to Poetry Magazine, and since that they've gotten that money, their field of who they publish has narrowed to the wildly famous. And and it's really hard to break into that shell that's built around publishing and around grant receiving and fellowship receiving. It's really difficult for a person, especially people who live in rural communities, to become known. That's really difficult. And so the business of poetry gets to be an overshadowing factor to the experience of writing and creating poetry, and that's a little sad in my opinion.
Right, because some of that can put out the holy fire to a certain extent, and I think writers need to be careful of that. What you said about people in rural areas, because I was wondering about you. I read that you live in Maine, and I think you have. I've read some of your work, and I can see you're very rooted in that land and in country. And I won't say by name this panel I was on, but I was on a panel one time, and there were other people on the panel with me determining poets who were, going to get poetry fellowship, and there was definitely a bias, if not downright prejudice, towards poets who write about the country, who write about rural areas and rural matters. The bias was towards the poem that had to do with matters urban.
Yes.
And that really bothered me. That stayed with me for many years now.
And also a real particular bias, I think, toward very young writers. And as a person who's not very young anymore, it's a little disturbing because our elder voices are so strong, and yet they often get swept away with the leaves. And that's a little off-putting for me, too. I know that we have amazing voices over 50, and yet it's like the flavor of the month, young person. And yes, we have wonderful young voices, too, but there doesn't seem to be a balance as far as I can tell. It's a little disturbing.
Do you think it's part of the overall American worship of youth?
I do. And except in the indigenous world, where elder voices really are respected. So then that pits the indigenous world against the non-indigenous world. And these opposing forces, if you want to call them that, really do damage to the literature. And that's distressing. Because if we didn't, and everything is supposed to be blind. It's supposed to be blind judging, blind reading, etc. But somehow, I'm not really convinced that that's completely the truth. And because I know of some amazing older voices who have just gotten left behind, left behind, left behind. And I know in the indigenous world, the elders eat first, the elders are respected and cared for and listened to, and their advice is heeded, and that does not happen in the dominant culture, and I think that's part of what's wrong.
Yeah, and I could see it creating a conflict. You talk about, while all indigenous people do not live in rural environments,
that's true.
A lot of them do, and a lot of the traditional sorts of or facets of their cultures do tend to be more rural in nature. And, if there's an obvious prejudice towards urban concepts, that's like two strikes against them. That's before they even go up to bat.
Right. That's true. And I think that's really sad. I guess more than being annoying, which it is, but more than that, it's sad, because there is so much richness that gets passed by or not looked at or ignored or discounted as just being too country, too rural, and therefore not smart enough or not clever enough, not insightful, and that's simply not the case.
Well, this is part of the fun I have when I give readings, because people do not usually place me as being a country woman, and I always make a point of saying that I come from the Catskills, and I stand up for country people and talk about the richness of mountain culture, and then by extension, Native culture in this area, but also in other areas. And then the whole matter of being an elder, being an older person. And I like to have some fun with it. I work with humor a lot, because if you come at people too seriously and you kind of lecture them, it shuts them down. And I find humor to be very transforming when I use it and when people hear it. And one thing I'm coming across when I give my readings, when I read these poems about people growing older, especially women growing older, I have people come up to me after I read and tell me how I have spoken, I have written what they have wanted to say, and they haven't felt brave enough to say it. And that's very gratifying to me. And I have women tell me they just feel really beaten down in silence, including some of the older ones who should be feeling very strong and dignified and proud, and they're feeling beaten down.
Yeah,
and that
I agree with
you. Outrageous.
It is. That's a good word for it, Susan, because it is outrageous. And especially when we have such good abilities for communication in the century in which we live, we should be celebrating and promoting women and people of all kinds of living conditions, whether it's mm-hmm. folks who still live on a reserve, or folks who mm-hmm. have moved to the city, or mm-hmm. people who live in a coastal area like I live. We should be celebrating all of that, because all of that makes up the fabric, which I think is really a good segue into, you know, unraveling the spreading cloth of time, you know, the anthology. It
right.
has that image of a fabric, and we're all part of a fabric. And if you start snipping away at little threads in the fabric is going to deteriorate. And we really need our fabric to be strong, not to be deteriorating. So I think the work that's in the anthology particularly does that well, to keep those threads tightly together and show the diversity, even within our own culture, the diversity from tribal group to tribal group, and yet also the oneness, that idea that we're all related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I agree. I was just thinking about that actually yesterday, Carol, about the diversity of people who are in the anthology from various parts of the country, and some on reserve reservations, you know, some living in cities, some living in various parts of country. And I really love that about the anthology, and that about bringing people together. I know that Mary Jo touched on this in her interview conversation, but some of this infighting among Native people, I really like that about the anthology, that it cuts through that divide and conquer stuff that's been going on. And there it all is, this gathering of people in one anthology. And I think that's quite the accomplishment.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one of the things that's so wonderful to me about the anthology, when it first arrived, you know, you don't know necessarily who all the people are whose work is in the anthology. So it comes, and you open it up, and you start looking, even if you just look at the table of contents, and you say, mm-hmm. oh, I've always wanted my poems to be next to those people's poems, and how wonderful it is to be in the same anthology with that person whose work I really have admired a long time. And so you start feeling a coming together. It's like arriving at a powwow and meeting a family member you haven't seen in a year, or going to walking down the street and running into a friend who introduces you to another friend who introduces you to another friend. And so by the time you get through the table of contents, even before you get to the poems, you feel like you've had a big reunion. And then you start looking at the poems and the other writing, and you say, oh, I love this. I love being in here with this person and being able to read this work and knowing this person's going to read my work.
Yeah. And
I'm with you. You put that beautifully. I'm with you on that. That's how I felt, too.
When I first got the anthology and started reading through it, so often when you read an anthology, it's put together like a patchwork quilt. It may have a pattern, but they're still distinct and separate blocks. In this particular case, it's literally woven together like a tapestry. Even though it's many voices come together, it's creating a very unique, harmonious tale. Whether you read each section alone as a standalone piece, or if you read it as a whole, it all comes together like a beautiful song.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, and that was unique in terms of my experience with anthologies, because it really does come together. It is woven together in a very cool way. I mean, there's no other way to put it. It just really did come together. And it's a very pleasant read, folks. If you have not picked up a copy, go to Amazon and search for Mary Jo Moore or Unraveling the Spreading Cloth of Time, and get the book. It's really, really worthwhile reading. Whether you have an interest in indigenous culture or just, you know, thoughts regarding the universe, it's a very, very interesting reading. Now, ladies, we are approaching time for a break. So while we are away, here's a thought for you. If you would like to help sponsor the Dawn of Shades by advertising on this program, you can contact me at gscott@exogenynetwork.com. And with that said, don't leave your computer, and we'll be right back with some more from our guests, Susan Deercloud and Carol Bockhoffner.
www.churchofmavisradio.com.
I am pleased to announce Truth Connections Radio is coming to UPRN 107.7 FM out of New Orleans at the Paranormal Radio Network. This is Catherine Buckaloo. Check out our archives at truthconnections.wordpress.com. Meanwhile, see you in October.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak.
Truth Connections.
Fox Tonight, Warner and Eli are lifelong friends.
You send one of mine to the hospital, I send one of yours to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Untouchable, that's right.
At work, they're moving up.
Well, hello, kitty.
We're going to get sued, Joe.
At home, their dads are moving in.
They want to flip for the bed?
Dad, there's no way you're sleeping in my head. Heads.
See you in the morning.
Good luck, guys.
Hey, you.
Dads premieres tonight at 8, 7 Central on Fox.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh. I can't.
cut my teeth on wedding rings in the movies, and I'm not proud of my address in a torn up town, no postcode envy. But every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We don't care, we're driving Cadillacs in our dream. But everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care, we aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royal. It's a run in our blood, that kind of love just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler. My friends and I would crack the code. We count our dollars on the train to the party, and everyone who knows us knows that we're fine with this. We didn't come for money. But every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room. We're driving Cadillacs in our dream, but everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care, we aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royal. It's a run in our blood, that kind of love just ain't for us. We crave a different kind of buzz. Let me be your ruler.
Dawn of Shade. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we're talking with two writers, both of whom contributed to the anthology Unraveling the Spreading Cloth of Time. Our guests tonight are Susan Deercloud and Carol Bachovner, and before we get started, I did want to put in a word from one of our sponsors tonight, MaryJoMoore.com. That's spelled MaryJoMoore. .com. She's a psychic. She also happens to be the one who edited the anthology that we have based this entire series, The Talking Threads, on. And the book is called Unraveling the Spreading Cloth of Time, Indigenous Thoughts Concerning the Universe. That's available at Amazon. It's real easy to find. You can probably get it on the list just by typing Unraveling and searching in the books for it. It's available both as an ebook and as a printed book. It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it. There again, that's what we have based this entire series on. And you can find out about Mary Jo in terms of her psychic work at maryjomoore.com. Now, ladies, we've talked about all sorts of things while we were on break, and the audience has no idea what wonderful insight they missed. But we will continue talking through the rest of the program tonight. You know, in terms of this revolution we're seeing in terms of printing, with the explosion of independent publishing of ebooks, of printed books, of audio books, audio files in terms of music and so forth and so on, do you see this affecting indigenous writers, musicians and so forth in a positive or a negative way?
I would say in a positive way. When I was a young woman, and when I first went to university, I don't remember Native literature being taught. I could hasten to say that in the past we were more of oral storytelling, but in recent years, I've just seen more and more Native voices getting out there, and I think it's wonderful. I see what Indigenous people are doing on the Internet, or the Sacred World Wide Web, as I like to call it. So I think it's made a big difference to us, and it's brought a lot of us together, and I marvel at that. I think it's great.
And Carol, your thoughts?
I think that the Internet and independent publishing, I think, has been a tremendous help to Indigenous writers and to people who want to be able to access Indigenous literature. Let's face it, libraries do not have big budgets for book buying anymore, and big publishers do not have big budgets to publish the way they used to. So I think that, you know, having these other venues for publishing and making literature of all kinds, but particularly Indigenous literature, available in a widespread way is just fantastic. We have people like Joseph Bruschak who does publish Indigenous writers through Bowman's Books and Greenfield Review, but those folks are few and far between. And so, you know, for a person to be able to access Indigenous cultures, whether out of curiosity or they heard a particular person read or heard a name and or heard about a particular work, they can access it in ways that were never possible before. And I agree with Susan, you know, when students in universities who are taking literature classes or Indigenous studies, I have a much wider range of available authors to encounter, mm-hmm. and that can only be a good thing. Even when I was an undergraduate, you know, the limits that were placed on us by mere availability and the lack of availability were so great that we didn't get to know very many authors. And yet those authors were out there writing and creating marvelous works, and they just weren't available to us. And it particularly was interesting to me that we only pretty much got the Native authors of the region where we were located. We didn't get authors from other regions. So now you can. Now you can get, you can find anybody's work. Someone can, you know, put my name into a search mm-hmm. engine and come up with my work, and any author that they want to. They can find a particular poem, or they can find
the availability to purchase a book or contact the author and ask a question, and that's amazing too. I get lots of those kinds of emails, and that's so much fun for me.
That is kind of unique.
It is. I got a fan letter a few years ago from someone in the Czech Republic asking me for an autographed photo. Now, that would never have been possible even a dozen years ago. Would never have been possible. But this person was able to access me somehow. I don't know how she found me, because we never got to that point where she told me that. But she found me, and she read some of my work, and she wanted an autographed photo. I was stunned by that. I was happy, but I was like, shocked.
With this availability being so much further reaching than it ever was, the first time I encountered a fan of the radio program, I had actually called my cell phone company's tech support department about my phone. I was cursing my phone. And the technician that was helping me had listened to the radio show. He recognized my voice. That was kind of creepy fun in a way. But another time I was on a bicycle ride on a trail here in Mississippi. And when it was over with, many things had gone wrong with the ride. But when it was over with, we were sitting there and sort of recharging before we loaded up and decided whether we were going to camp another night or go home or what we were going to do. And here comes a couple of guys from the big city on the, that was on the one end of the bicycle trail, which is Hattiesburg, which is far from big city, but here in Mississippi it's good sized. Anyhow, they had listened to the radio program. In fact, one of them was listening to it on his iPod while he was pedaling along, which that was kind of cool, I didn't realize that anybody in Mississippi even listened to the program. At that time, the program was still primarily focused on paranormal topics. And, in the heart of the Bible Belt, you wouldn't think that paranormal would be a big topic for people to be listening to. But, yeah, that was kind of cool. So, it is funny, with social media, we share things back and forth. Then we are introduced to somebody's writing or music or artwork or whatever that we would not have otherwise ever perhaps heard about.
I
so
know,
we're
it's
seeing
fantastic.
A huge explosion.
It's fantastic.
I find
That matter of being in touch with people from all around the world, from other countries, and and then to have a fan from the Czech Republic or whatever it is, and
I know, it's amazing.
Despite what I said at the beginning of the program, it is kind of lovely to be regarded as a goddess. I have to admit it. To be revered a little bit for our work, to be honored for our work. I've met people from Burma, now they call it Myanmar, but they addressed me as honorable poet. For any poet who lives in America, that is a beautiful thing.
There are people
in other parts of the world who really consider poets to be honorable and who respect us for what we do.
Well, at the same time, there's a sort of an air of mysticism about poets and writers and musicians. that people think that you have glamorous lives and live the lifestyle of the rich and famous. And that doesn't matter whether you write poetry, record music, write books, or do an internet radio show. For some reason, they think you have a glamorous life. Do you encounter this?
I do. I, for one, I never cook, I never clean a toilet, and I never sweep the floor.
Certainly not.
My broom is for flying around on. My life is extremely glamorous.
Yeah, we have a brand new carpet at my house. My good old dog, who's been with me a long, long time, it's fall, and that's when she blows her coat, and she has lots of hair. She used to have lots of hair. She no longer has the hair. It's now our new carpet. And we'll spend the next 6 months.
I thought you were going to tell me to fly around on that carpet.
Well, see, now my secret's out. That's how I travel and save money on gas, is by using my flying carpet made of my dog's hair. Yeah, magical, mystical dog hair carpet.
Yeah, so exactly. It's better than a broom. It's better than a broom.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah,
that broom's
getting hurt a little.
Well, that's the other thing, is somehow people get this crazy idea that creating poetry is not work. It's really witchcraft. You know, it's something mystical, magical that flies in out of the sky and lands on the page, and your job is just to put it out there. And you have to laugh at that because it's so silly, but it really, you hear it over and over again. Oh, it's just, it must be wonderful to have that gift. And I think of all the hours I put in and the sweat and tears over every word, and I think, oh yeah, it's a real gift, all right, but sometimes it's a gift that's painful to open. So I just love the idea that of poetry as witchcraft. It makes me chuckle.
You know, another misconception people often entertain is that indigenous people spend their time sitting around a campfire in a teepee, of course, smoking a peace pipe, going, oh, we'll never crack a smile. And yet a very important part of most indigenous cultures is humor, which we have been, you know, taking out and giving an airing right now with our magic carpets and flying brooms, you know. You know, you guys want to talk a little bit about humor in indigenous cultures?
I think probably the best example of that for me is Sherman Alexie. He is one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. And it just, he's so ironic, and his humor is very dry. And it just, his wit is just sharp at all times. And it's, you're right, it's not the image that the world seems to have of us. But we're really funny people. Belly laughing, fall down on the floor, funny. And it just, you know, the image that the world has is so bizarre. I was at a ball game in Fenway Park on Saturday, and I saw this woman wearing a Washington Redskins T-shirt. And suddenly, you know, the other part of us is we're known to speak our minds. So I just said to her, I was standing in line with her, and I said to her, do I look like a mascot to you? And then I started laughing to myself inwardly, thinking, she thinks I'm really nuts. But it's good to be a little nuts, you know, whether you're being funny or you're confronting an issue. And if you can confront an issue with humor, all the better, because then the person doesn't get really upset. They makes them stop and think a little bit. And I think indigenous people's humor does that. It's so ironic and dry, and you have to, like, shake your head and say, wait a minute, did he or she just say that? And in between laughing and falling on the floor, you learn something. So I think indigenous humor is very much present, and it's really a good teaching tool.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we're of an age where we grew up with the old cowboy and Indian movies, and so many of the native people in those films, often played by Italians or whoever else, were presented as never, ever smiling. And the first movie for me that really went against that stereotype was Little Big Man. And,
was that hilarious? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that was great. And I was I just opened up so much for me. I was so appreciative of that film. And what you said about Sherman Alexie, did either of you see the Bill Moyers interview of Alexie?
No.
I suspected this with him when I heard him read at Syracuse University some years. I thought he was bipolar. And he was all over the place. It was almost like a stand-up comedy act more than giving a reading. But at one point, he just kind of crashed and got really serious and I thought depressed looking. Well, when I saw the interview of him, he came out and he talked about his being bipolar and he's on medicine for that now. Mm-hmm. And I've thought about Alexie, and of course we're all familiar with his work, and I extend this to a lot of other Native people. A lot of Native people know immense pain. I've always remembered one Native man saying all Indian people are born with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And Sherman Alexie apparently is somebody who's known immense pain and suffering, and yet he's been able to be extremely funny.
And I think that really is very healing, because he's willing to use his own life, his own particular pains, in such a way that it makes other people realize that this is a fellow human being in front of them who suffers along with them, and it puts people at their ease. And he's willing to confront all kinds of issues with humor. And certainly, his books—if you read his books—you that humor comes through along with the pain. And I'm thinking in particular about his characters Victor and Thomas, and I've heard Sherman read in person many times, and so I hear his voice in my head, and that makes it twice as funny for me. And so I look forward to, when I read his work, where's that voice, where's that funny guy, and knowing full well that he's fueling his funny with his pain and vice versa. And I think that's really amazing. It's an amazing talent. And I think that kind of humor is indigenous to the indigenous person.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, when I go to give a reading, I always make sure I read some of my poems that have humor in them. And I love to see people laugh when I give a reading. That means a lot to me. And I've gone to poetry readings that I call, just kill me now readings, because I've heard some poets, they just read poem after poem after poem about war, genocide, suicide. Now every depressing aspect of human life, that's all it is. And, I feel a kind of responsibility to people when I give a reading to present different parts of life, not just that horror part of it. And sometimes I think there are too many poets in this country who miss that poetry is also celebratory, that it's not just this other thing about every aspect of existence that is sad and tragic. And I love this about so many of the indigenous writers I know, that they write about the beauty of life. They can write about what's funny, what's sexy. They can have fun with things. And then they can have the poems that are straightforwardly serious and tragic, but they look at all of it, and I admire that so much.
It's interesting that you talk about, you know, the being bombarded with these really horrible negative things, you know, recently on my Facebook page, actually, I was feeling somewhat overwhelmed because many of the people that are on my list do post a lot of really tragic, horrible things, and they're real issues, and they are important. However, mm-hmm. you know, we can become, I felt like I was drowning in it, and I actually posted a warning, you know, for the next few days, I am only going to read and post happy, cheerful, joy, joy, joy sort of things, because mm-hmm. I feel a need for some positive in my life right now. And
well, something psychologically weird happens with that. All of that, and I'm certainly a person who's extremely aware of what's going on all around the world, but I mean, to me, it's important to bring some joy to other people and to dance and laugh a little bit. And again, I very often find that some of the people who have suffered the most and experienced the most tragedy have also learned to appreciate the most what laughter and celebration means to life, how important that is.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, sometimes we do need to sort of leaven our input and output just to create balance, I guess you might say.
Because balance is a big indigenous word, as you know.
It's yeah.
Balance.
And it's a yeah. very big, it's a very big concept, and I think it's a concept that the non-indigenous world talks about but doesn't maybe understand as much, and that is the idea that, yes, there is something sad in the world, but it's going to be balanced somewhere in the world with something equally bright. And so that mm-hmm. idea of balance is really important to us, just as we have the moon and the sun and daytime and nighttime, and we have the seasons of the year. All of those create that balance. And so the people who pay attention to the natural world probably get a little bit more pleasure out of their lives because they know that balance is there and the good is coming when they're suffering something that's not so good. And mm-hmm. and yet you look on Facebook or on television or read in the newspapers and there seems to be this overwhelming preponderance of the negative. And I was thinking when you were talking, Susan, that years ago someplace, I think it was Vermont, but I could be wrong about that, someone started a newspaper that was going to only publish good news. And they called it the Good News. And they went out of business in less than a year because no one wanted to read just good news.
Well,
and I thought, wow, that is, me too. And I thought, that is really sad. There is a lot of sadness in the idea that people would take more pleasure in somebody's bad fortune than in hearing about something wonderful happening. And the Germans have a word for that. They call it Schadenfreude. And taking pleasure in somebody else's misfortune. And I just don't get that concept at all. To me, that doesn't factor in. I love hearing when somebody triumphs over some adversity or some sweet little thing happens to someone. And it can be little, you know, it's, you can take pleasure in just the smallest thing, you know, just seeing a bird at your bird feeder and or hearing it coming. And yet that kind of news isn't going to make it into the paper.
No, and it's unfortunate.
But it can make it into our poems, though.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
think
well,
that's
the other part of poetry, that bringing careful attention to a bird coming to a feeder or to light falling on a raindrop on a fallen leaf, whatever it is.
Yes.
That's part of the beauty of being a poet. When I've taught, I've always told my students this wonderful thing about being a poet is that we always remain childlike, not childish, but childlike, and we always keep ourselves open to all of that around us and see that kind of beauty in what some people call the little things, but they're not little things at all. And then I see other people, they become so shut down to all of that, sometimes at a very early age. It's really a sorrowful matter that people get that beaten down. They're no longer open. They're no longer bringing careful attention to life, to all beings.
And I think you're right, Susan. I think that's one of the beautiful things about poetry is that because we work with so few words in a space, that we have to be very careful of the words we use. So we want to portray something that brings us pleasure or captures our attention, even if it's something that's not happy. And we try to find that right word or phrase to bring the reader in and have them not just read about it, but experience it for themselves. And when you describe light falling on a leaf, for example, you want the person to be able to close his or her eyes and see that. So you're careful about what you say, and you're careful about how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think poetry does that. Poetry and music do that better than any other genres, I think, because you rely so much on the imagination of the reader and being able to connect in such a personal and sacred way with the reader when you take that kind of care over a single word.
Also, the whole matter of indigenous languages, and sorrowfully, I don't know any native language well. I know a little bit about Mohawk and Seneca, but it intrigued me when Chief Tom Porter wrote that indigenous languages are languages in 3D, as he put it. And he drew analogy, and I felt this way for a long time, he drew analogy between indigenous languages and the language of poetry, because he said that indigenous languages are more imagistic, you know, a couple of words can contain a whole lot, can be very descriptive in a 3D, very deep way, very expansive way. And I've sometimes thought one of the reasons I write poetry is I'm recovering some kind of lost language. It may not just be Turtle Island indigenous. It may have to do with something female, something woman, or something all human beings hunger for. And we're in this world of sound bites and language used as lies. Political type language that's very deadening to the human spirit. And poetry, of course, is very enlivening. It brings us into life in a more intense way.
I agree.
I think when we go out amongst people in general, or even people just walking down the street in front of my house, so often you see, or hear rather, that it's primarily a string of various obscenities and cuss words with occasional English words strung in between them. And, you know, it's not very expressive. It's pretty limited vocabulary. And it kind of reminds me, you know, when I was a girl and, you know, all children go through a phase of being fascinated by the various cuss words that you get in trouble for saying. And I can remember my mother saying, people who use those words use them because they aren't smart enough to find another word. And that sort of took away the enchantment of foul language for me, because obviously I was smarter than that. And, you know, if you're just using it because you're not very smart, you know, it wasn't all that intriguing anymore. But do you think that this proliferation of foul language in music in movies and television and society in general, do you think that it is beginning to restrict some of the expressiveness of the American culture in general?
Yeah, I do. On the other hand, I also think it's kind of a sign of people being a little more daring. I don't like to hear foul language just for the sake of it being there, but I lived in London for a little while, and they use the F word all the time, but it doesn't have the same power it seems to have here. It's just a word. It's like saying "oh darn," or "drat," or "ouch," or any kind of little blurt of expression. It doesn't have the horrible connotation that it's gotten here. And so, I have mixed feelings about it. I would prefer to hear people use beautiful language all the time, because beautiful language makes me feel beautiful. But the foul language doesn't make me feel foul, which is really an interesting dichotomy, I guess. It just makes me notice that.
Once upon a time,
doesn't make me feel bad.
Once upon a time, the foul language was used for shock value. It got your attention and brought attention to the rest of the statement, whatever it was. Whether it was a comedian using it on stage, or it was used in a song, or it was used in a written piece, it shocked the listener or reader into the point of paying attention to what followed after. And as a punctuation mark, it's now used so much that nobody pays attention to it.
Yeah.
I agree with that, and Gia, and I think there's a prismatic relationship between what's in a human being's heart, mind, and what comes out of the mouth. And in Haudenosaunee culture, people of the longhouse culture, anything we say is believed to stay with the part of the earth we say it on. And anything we say is believed to come from our spirit, and when it comes out of our mouth, it mingles with everybody else's voices and breath and everything there is on earth. And so it's a big responsibility, what we do with our words. There's always been an immense respect for the word. Among Haudenosaunee Iroquois people and other indigenous people too. So we choose our words as carefully as we can choose them. And it's amazing that you brought that up about the use of the F word and this sort of language, because when I was walking in town today to go to the post office, I saw an older man holding a teenage boy between his legs. He kind of had him wedged, and the teenager was just coming out with a string of words like that in a really loud voice. And the two of them were going back and forth. It was just one of these little scenes that I come across every so often. And, maybe a well-placed curse word can do something meaningful, but when it becomes all of that and not language that's deep with thought, I think that may be reflecting something not so good about what's going on in our country.
And, I also think that... Go ahead. I was thinking when you were saying that sometimes people who use that kind of language all the time, it seems to be every other word coming out of their mouth, I think it's because they really are at a loss for what they want to say. So that's their fallback position. They fall back into this, well, if I can't really say what I mean, if I cuss and cuss and cuss and cuss, maybe it'll come to me.
or I'll at least get attention. And, you know, there's a saying in the world of psychology, someone wants to get attention, and they'll either get positive attention or negative attention, but they're going to get attention. And I think that sometimes what happens, especially with younger people, they want to be heard, but they don't know exactly what they want to say because they haven't been that thoughtful or careful, and they haven't been trained to be that thoughtful or careful. Maybe it's a generational thing. Their parents did those kinds of things, so they don't know anything else. So I think that's why poetry is so important, because we get to be masters of language, really. We hold the language. Janet Fitch, who is a wonderful fiction writer, she wrote White Oleander, is probably her most famous book. She said that when she was in graduate school, her fellow students used to make fun of the poets until they realized one day that the poets hold the language. And then it wasn't so good to make fun of the poets anymore, because the poets had the key to what they needed in writing fiction, which was beautiful language. So that always stuck with me, what she said.
That's a very true statement, because a lot of words, the first time I encountered them was in a poem. And, you know, one of the wonderful things in my life is, you know, a vocabulary. And perhaps often for a lot of these people, because when you erase the curse words from their statement, the curse words had no meaning.
Yeah, and then you ask yourself, what's left in that statement, and not so much.
No, they lack. They apparently are lacking the vocabulary to express themselves clearly. So they're making this sound that we interpret as a curse word. That sound itself has meaning, not the word, the sound.
Sound and the tone, and maybe it sort of equates. They might as well be just saying blah 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 blah, because there's the same lack of meaning there. So, you know, when I hear lots and lots of cuss words, I really have pity for the person, because I think what that person could use right now is a dictionary.
Yeah.
And some
and as the current expression goes, perhaps a hug, because what I saw today with the boy, the teenage boy, I felt I was seeing a wounded animal, and a lot of that cursing. I think there are a lot of people walking around who are very frustrated, wounded, hungering people.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
They don't have the gift, the means for figuring out what to do about that. And of course, we are in hard times, and we all know about the increasing gap between rich and poor and the forever war and everything else that's going on. But I don't like to see it. It really troubles me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it sounds a little cliche to say what we need is love, but it is what we need. We need understanding, we need to be seen, and we need to be heard, and we need to be understood, and we need to be have our dignity back. And I think when you hear these young people particularly, just they're so frustrated to the point, and they don't have the words to ask for what they really need, and maybe they don't even have the ability to identify what they really need. They think they need things, or they think they need money, and what they need is human touch and human interaction and to be seen and heard. And so, yeah, I think the proliferation of cursing in all areas has to do with frustration more than malintent or violence. I think it really is more frustration and a deep cry for help.
So when we're talking about, you know, this frustration and this lack of understanding, we know that the indigenous population suffers from frustration, lack of understanding from the outside world. you know, and all the other things that, that have happened, you know, all the history in the past 300-400 years and so forth and so on. And it's created this, this gulf between indigenous societies and mainstream society that just doesn't seem to heal particularly well. Do you think that the explosion in technology that's resulted in greater expression for everyone in many ways will help create an understanding that eventually could lead to a more healing relationship?
I do. I do. For all the reasons that we talked about before regarding technology, the more you have ability to encounter someone, the greater the chance is that you will come to understand that person. And so, yeah, I think if people can, you know, encounter me, whether it's on Facebook or at a reading or, you know, through mail or email or instant message, I think that's the greater chance they're going to have to understand me and where I'm coming from in my thinking and my culture, and I'm going to get a chance to understand them too.
Mm-hmm.
I think that can only be a good thing.
And you, Susan?
Well, I was kind of thinking about you, Carol, because you've also, you've taught, and tell me if you've had this experience, because this has been mine. Well, even when we go out to give readings, we're teaching, but I've come across a lot of students and then just people at readings who feel a lot of connection with indigenous ways. And sometimes I tell them, well, everybody's indigenous if they go back far enough, but I come across people who feel that they've lost something important to them, and they look to people who are indigenous to this country for what they feel that they're hungering for. So they're looking for something.
I have encountered that, and I do all the time, really. And people are very quick to say to me, well, I know that there were Native people in my family. I just don't know who they were,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know how to find that out. And it's a painful thing. And so, I guess the way I look at it is, if when I read my poetry to them, that I'm giving them back some little piece of that, and that makes me feel very happy.
I feel the same way. I come across this immense hungering and wistfulness on the part of a lot of people. And by the way, that matter with people cursing, if it may be out of some kind of pain and frustration. I've sometimes had younger people say this to me: oh, I really like your voice. It's so soft and gentle. This has really amazed me. It's as if they're not used to any voice that's quiet or soft and gentle.
Or they're not used to quiet at all, because the world is so loud.
This is true.
And
this
so
is true.
When they encounter a soft voice, they're immediately captured by it. And I know when I have a lot of kids, and when they were young, I found that the best way to get their attention was to whisper.
It's funny you mention that. I happen to frequently get laryngitis if I've had a cold or the flu or anything. And one time, a number of years ago when my kids were young, the laryngitis lasted for about 6 weeks, which is a really long time to be without uh-huh. your voice. And I discovered that, because they would be out playing in the backyard, and we had a large backyard, and it used to be I'd open the window and I'd have to yell several times to tell them it was time to come in for supper and whatnot. While I had laryngitis, I could open that window and whisper out the window, and at the very furthest point of the yard, they could hear me.
Isn't that funny? That's really amazing. But I think that's true.
Yeah.
And it worked like a charm. It was so wonderful. And yet we really are bombarded with all this loudness. That's the other thing I love about living where I live, is it's very quiet. And the street I live on is very quiet. And so
same for me.
And my husband and I have a quiet life. We're quiet in our house. Not that we don't enjoy cranking the music up from time to time. We really do, and we like to dance. But we really like our quiet. It just is so healing.
I think sometimes that there's a difference between someone who's grown up or lived most of their life in an urban environment versus country environment. Because in my case, my husband lived in a city most of his life. Even though his family was from the mountains, he grew up in the city and spent most of his time there. And, you know, our ideas of sound levels can differ. There's times when I literally will say, you know, my ears are tired. You know, even a soft radio in the background can become incredibly loud to me. And yet other times he can play things loud as can be and I'm tuning it out. I don't even hear it. I'm not registering it. But there are times when I'm like, I just can't take the noise anymore. We got to turn it off. And, you know, there is a difference. I think country people in general learn to be comfortable with more natural sounds. You know, which most people...
My magnificent other, as I call him, grew up in Brooklyn. And what you just described, Gia, is exactly as it is with him and me.
Yeah, yeah. And even
I can sit for hours in silence, and he likes to play music loud, and
noise
he told me we'd have people here 24 hours a day, every day of the week, every week of the month, every month of the year. He likes it like that, and I'm quiet.
Yeah,
I'm fortunate because my husband likes it quiet too. So
You are very fortunate.
Well, at the same time, perhaps it teaches us to compromise a little.
That's true. There's that.
You know, because we do have.
I'm trying to look at it like that as a learning experience.
Yeah, because there is a difference because. You know, the absolute silence that I'm so comfortable with, other people will, you know, because I may go hours and not say anything. It's not because I'm giving anybody the silent treatment. I just don't have anything to say. You know, there's a difference between angry silence and just silence. And many people will interpret me not saying anything as some sort of silent treatment, and coworkers in particular. And that's not necessarily true. People who are comfortable with silence can be very quiet.
That's true.
Also, some of us like to listen. And speaking of what's indigenous, we are listeners. We are listeners. I don't have to be talking all the time.
Right. So I do love to talk. I will say I love to talk.
I guess it's good
because we're right here talking.
We're talking
well,
away.
good thing we're both willing to do it.
Yeah.
I love good conversation, and then I like to listen, and I've enjoyed listening to the two of you, and I grew up listening.
Yeah, you know, and the listening... I think that's an important part for, well, writers and poets in particular, because if you don't listen, how can you hear other stories?
That's true.
That's right. I grew up listening to stories, and getting back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this program with elders, older people, I was very fortunate to grow up around older people, around grandparents and great aunts and great uncles and aunts and uncles and all kinds of older people who told me stories. And that, too, there was no division between the generations when I was growing up. We were all together. And there was an immense richness of life in that.
I think it's really lovely when multiple generations spend time together, especially when there's young people amongst them. I was fortunate mm-hmm. enough to also to grow up with elderly people. My great-grandparents, most of them were still alive. They'd been born in the 1800s. So the stories I heard were from a much quieter time. But they also provide me with ample humor because I can remember one great-grandmother's fascination with convenience foods. You know, she came from an era where there was no such thing. You ate what you grew, you know, and every commercial would come on, she would have to ask the grocery store to order her some. And some of it was really, because this is in the 60s, some of it was really awful. And the one I remember the best was, it was a cereal, but I don't remember if it was a hot cereal or cold cereal. But whatever you were supposed to add to it, whether it was hot water or cold milk, these petrified strawberries were supposed to plump up and be just like fresh ones. And I will never forget this because she has the box of cereal, she does her thing with it, and there we sit with this bowl of stuff for these brown petrified lumps that didn't look like anything edible, and they certainly weren't chewable, that stayed brown petrified lumps. And she was so immensely disappointed.
Have you written about this?
No, I actually never have, but I can still remember her immense disappointment because that's not what the commercial told her was going to happen. Yeah, and, you know, there were many
that's
other things, too.
That's strawberries.
The strawberries that stick in my mind. You know, this is a girl that had grown up with horse and buggies and seen a man land on the moon. And here she is disappointed over petrified strawberries.
Yeah, I thought about that with my grandparents, my great-aunts and uncles. Everything they saw from when they were children to the ends of their lives. Because, again, you know, they grew up with horse and buggy, sleighs, walking to the one-room schoolhouse, all of it, living back in the woods. And they went through these immense changes, and now I feel that I and we are going through similar immense changes.
One of the best educated people I've ever known was my grandmother. And she actually only went to school 3 years, because to go to school, they had to live away from home, just the kids alone, in a one-room cabin near the schoolhouse. And a couple of times during the year, my great-grandfather would come and bring food and whatnot for them and check on them. These kids were living alone during the school year. They only came home during the summer. And they didn't go every year. I think they went every other year. But in 3 years, she completed all 8 grades. And she never stopped learning. She continued to read and expand her own education. And she knew a lot about a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And when people,
well,
I tell people,
this is something a lot of us, in that whole matter of education, because now there's so much emphasis put on all the testing and getting the degrees, but so many of us grew up with older people who were very, very smart, very learned, even though they had not been to college and often had not graduated from high school, but a lot of them had wisdom, and they had all kinds of knowledge. And that's something I like to talk to people about when I give my poetry readings or when I teach. And I've known a lot of people who have a lot of formal education through the schools and colleges, but they lack wisdom. Not all of them, but I've met too many who lack wisdom.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how much emphasis we place on education and how uneducated so many people really are. I know that, you know, living here in Mississippi, which unfortunately Mississippi ranks last in about every ranking you can put it on, and education is one of them. And I've known friends' kids who have graduated from high school and whatnot, and they couldn't write a basic, understandable business letter. Could not write it. they were barely able to read at a sixth grade level. And yet these kids were usually honor roll students who had successfully, according to the state, completed high school. And, you know, the whole focus, you know, that I'm watching, you know, this No Child Left Behind stuff, was that instead of teaching the kids anything, they're now teaching them the stuff they need to pass the test. That's all they spend their time on. And unfortunately, it lacks most practical application, which to me, you know, basic literacy and ability to write are critical things, because you can't do anything if you can't do those things.
Well, I sit on the school board in my town, and I keep harping and harping and harping about we need to get rid of high-stakes testing, because all it leads to is other testing. It doesn't lead to learning at all. And now many states, including the state of Maine, want to tie teachers' salaries to test results. So that's going to make it even more so that teachers will be teaching to the test, if for no other reason than to hang on to their paychecks. And that's just awful. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to lead to trying to shuffle students who are poor achievers, poor test takers, into special ed programs to get them off of that teacher's role, you might say. And that's a little sad, too. I grew up in Iowa, and Iowa is known for its Iowa Basic Skills. And they test this. I went to I actually graduated from a high school that had been an experimental high school. It tested us seven ways to Sunday, often, frequently, continuously. They taught us how to take tests. And tests are not intimidating to me, but I have a daughter who waited 2 years longer than she had to get her driver's license, despite the fact she loved independence. And I was pestering her to go get her driver's license, because she was so afraid of the written test. You know, and was it because she didn't know the material? She knew the material. She just didn't happen to be a good test taker. She was afraid of tests. And, you know, did the tests mean anything? Not really. Not when I was going to school. It was just they were measuring thousands and thousands of school kids across the entire state, and comparing each other's in whatever government office did all this comparison. And what did they discover? I have no idea. It hasn't done me a world of good to be a good test taker. It's not like my paycheck is based on my test scores. You know, so did the teachers that made a difference in my life, would they have done as well if all they had been focused on was making everyone achieve at a certain level on that test? I don't think so.
I don't think so either. It's kind of the idea of testing is making me nuts here. It's the thing I focus on so much. And it, you know, it just gives me a headache, because I just want people to be logical about it and see it as it really is, and yet we're a slave to the money that comes from the federal government because of the testing. At some point in time, somebody's got to say, no, we'll do without that money, because what we care about more is our students and their being able to think and express themselves. And I seem like I'm just beating my head against a brick wall.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, that word slave, I think a lot of this testing is intended to turn people into slaves. I don't like it. I've taught students who come into their early years of college and university, and because of the testing, they come in, they're practically cringing. When they write in boxes and rectangles. If I tell them I would like them to be creative and I want to hear what they have to say, what they think, and what they feel, initially a lot of them look at me as if I'm insane. And, you know, by the end of the semester, they're usually very happy about what they're doing, but they're not used to that. They're seriously, some of them look shocked. just shocked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm very skeptical. I'm very, I could say, suspicious about what all this testing is about. And now we have what is known as the corporate university. And this other matter of testing, it seems to me it's playing into this class system in America that everybody pretends doesn't exist. And I've come across a lot of people who are well-heeled money-wise to send their kids to school outside of the regular school so they can learn to test well, so they do, so they get high scores on the SATs or whatever else it is they need to get into a good college.
Mm-hmm.
And that means the other kids are not as likely to test out as high as the kids who get trained to take tests.
Right.
It's extremely unfair. And again, just this focus on testing, it makes the students, you know, they're constantly under stress. They're constantly being made to feel anxious.
Well, talk about anxious. We have run out of time, ladies.
No way.
Yes, seriously.
My, how time flies when we're having a good time.
Yes, it does.
Yes.
It does. Well, I want to thank you both for coming on tonight. I've had a lot of fun with both of you.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank you both.
So, folks, I hope that tonight's program has brought everyone plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your own personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next week as we continue the series featuring Native American writers who contributed to the book Unraveling the Spreading Cloth of Time. With all of that to tease and tantalize you, I bid you farewell. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.